Welcome, everybody. My name is Eric Jacobson. I am a Presbyterian pastor and a doctoral student at Fuller Seminary. I teach a few classes there and do some gigs like this occasionally, talking about neighborhood life and churches. I just finished a session which was sort of heavy on the imagery and the PowerPoint, and it was mostly me talking. I would like this session to be a little different. I'd like a little more interaction and discussion on this one. So we've dropped the PowerPoint. We're going old school with this. So hopefully you guys come with some ideas about where people are living and decisions people are making about where they're living. I'd like to frame a discussion and get your input on that. So this may be sort of a dangerous way to get into it, but I hear the term postmodernism thrown around quite a bit. And in church circles and ministry circles, I hear this notion of postmodern ministry. And since I turned 40 this fall, I'm officially out of it. So I'm not always sure exactly what people mean when they say postmodern ministry. So the first thing I want you to maybe enlighten me on is, what do you think people mean when they say postmodern ministry? Okay, asking questions, less dogmatic in our assertions, okay? Anything else that characterizes postmodern ministry? What about the images? You don't have to define it very well, but is there an image that comes to your mind of what a postmodern ministry ought to look like? What's that? Candles, okay. Are tattoos part of the image, or is that the old school postmodern?
Coffee
shops, okay. That's not new, yeah.
Music written after 1970.
Okay. Yeah, some more musical styles. Okay, good. I'm going to try to get at one aspect of postmodern ministry that I think is often not on the radar in terms of postmodernism. I'm not proposing to replace or advocate some new, brand new way of talking about postmodernity, but I do think the notion of geography is key for understanding postmodern ministry. And that's what I want to focus in on, how geography plays a role in our ministry models. One of my most helpful guides to postmodernity has been Albert Borgman, who's a philosopher, and he wrote this book, Crossing the Postmodern Divide. And what's been most helpful about Borgman is, before trying to track current trends, which is, I think, what a lot of people talking about postmodern modernity are doing. They're trying to track current trends and make sense backwards of what's happening and try to systematize and understand it. Borgman, like some others, is saying that postmodernity is not really gelled as anything coherent yet. Postmodernity, what holds it all in common is this notion that something's wrong with modernity and something else needs to replace it. But we haven't yet figured out what that's going to be. We're at sort of this watershed point where we're going to start creating some models for that. Like some other authors, he thinks there's a high possibility that the choice offered to us now is sort of a hypermodernism or something else. So a lot of things that go by the name of postmodern have not really solved the problem of modernity. They haven't understood what the problem of modernity was. So I'm going to begin talking about Borgman's notion of what characterized modernity, so that we can evaluate things that purport to be postmodern based on how much they offer an alternative to the modern model. So we will begin with three characteristics that I'm getting from Borgman directly. The first characteristic is what he calls aggressive realism. And that is the notion that nature does not hem us in the conditions of the natural world, don't hem us in, but we can conquer them through technology, through our power, through industry. And so aggressive realism, sort of during the industrial era, would involve stripping natural resources. You see a forest and you think, well, we can cut all these trees down. You see a chasm and you think, we can put a rail line over that. Nature doesn't need to hold us in. We can conquer nature through technology. We've become a little more cautious about that in the current generation. We're not stripping resources at the same rate that we were before, maybe with the exception of maybe oil. But we still have that mentality that we can conquer the contingency of nature through technology. The easiest way to see it is through building technology. This isn't really a classic example, but it's pretty close. This building could be built and placed anywhere in the world in any climatic conditions, and through its heating and air conditioning system would keep us at a pretty comfortable level. It doesn't need to use any of the natural conditions of climate in order to make it work. And so a lot of architecture now is based on that notion that we can solve any problem that might come about because of the climate based on the technology of the building. Same thing with communications technology, transportation technology. You can have fresh fruit in Michigan any time of year because it's brought to you. I'm from California, so I can't brag about the fresh fruit that I get. It's maybe a little cheaper. But it can be brought to you. I can, co-parent with my wife right here using the cell phone. The distance doesn't matter. And so all these ways of conquering the contingencies of life through technology is what Borden calls aggressive realism. We don't need to change our behavior because of conditions, but we can just use technology to overcome all those conditions. The second feature of modernity is, I don't know if I can spell this. Methodological universalism. That is the notion that, that's a big word, say that to your friends, impress them all. Methodological universalism is this notion that if we focus on a single method, it will unlock the secrets of the universe and help us to harness the powers of the universe. It was most clearly established in the scientific method, that there's sort of a method of scientific inquiry that in order to be valid, the experiment needs to work in any place that you might do it. It's not place specific. The experiment needs to work anywhere. And if you follow this strict set of methods for testing and verifiability, you will help to establish a body of scientific knowledge. And the scientific community has been based on methodological universalism. We also see it in the factory system. You know, the Henry Ford's notion of the assembly line and putting automobiles together. And the factory system is based on this notion that if we come up with a method where we break down all the processes of constructing an automobile and break down each one into a separate entity and then make each part of that process as efficient as possible, we will have a system that will allow us to build cars more efficiently. And you'll see that mentality sort of governing almost all the things that are built today, from cars to houses to whatever. It's all standardized and a sort of universal method of doing things. And the third one ambiguous individualism. And that is the notion that I am sort of the most important entity for decisions that are made in life. And so that can be seen in a lot of ways. That probably maybe can be traced all the way back to Martin Luther and the notion that the individual can interpret the scriptures for themselves, and that is sufficient reason to take a different turn from the church. That the whole Protestant mentality was sort of based on that notion of sort of religious individualism, if you will. That's maybe putting it a little bit too generally, but that was sort of one thing. Political individualism, that one person, one vote, doesn't matter what class you are, eventually you get to the point, doesn't matter what race you are or what gender you are, you can vote. All those were, I think, very good developments, but in a way, we're abstracting. One person, one vote means that from a political standpoint, I don't have a personal identity. I'm just a political, I'm one vote, and you're one vote. We're a number rather than a set of personal characteristics. Now what we're seeing more and more is economic individualism, that I vote with my dollars. And so the way the decisions are made in many countries now is based on the vote of the market. What consumers want is what is produced. And that's also abstract to me. I'm not an individual with personal characteristics. I'm a customer of a certain kind. And what matters most isn't who I am, but how much money I represent. And so I am a number in terms of a disposable income or something like that. So all this is sort of an individual way. Even now, you'll see people talking about community, but not in a way that really gets past individualism. It's sort of community as a consumer commodity. You know, this notion of, and Robert Bella, I think, has a word. Is it nostalgic community or something like that? This notion that I'm going to buy into a community. I'm going to move to a certain place. I'm going to do this. And all of a sudden, I will have community. Or I'll have a community-like experience by going to this kind of thing. And, you know, you're still the sovereign individual in doing that. You'll be part of this community as long as it's useful to you and pleasurable to you, but you can easily escape that community as soon as it no longer is. And so there, you still see individualism in that, even as people are interested in community. All these things are good in their own way. They've certainly, you know, there's been benefits. We're living longer. We're allowing people who were oppressed to exercise political roles that they never could before. Anyway, there's a lot of good from all these. All of these, though, have a kind of shadow side that we've come to realize. So aggressive realism, yes, we can conquer nature in a lot of respects. Yes, we can have fresh fruit in Michigan, but, you know, global warming is starting to concern people, and maybe nature is going to fight back at some point. There's a limit to how much we can just sort of outsmart nature with our technology. Methodological universalism is great. You can buy products now cheaper in relative terms than you could many years ago. You can get any kind of food anywhere, but it all is seems to be of a less good quality. There's kind of what we call a McDonaldization factor. Everything feels kind of sterile and feels kind of standard. Ambiguous individualism, the shadow side there is people, I think, as much as we've got increased technology for communicating with people through cell phones and through the internet, people are probably lonelier now than they've ever been in human history. There's a sense that we have not solved very much by way of our need for community with all of our individualism. So these are Borgman's, these are his main criteria for what is part of the modern project. And then here we'll come up with an alternative to that. But before that, I want to see if we can place the church, some of the church ministries, in some of these models. So maybe just to kind of prime the pump a bit, if you want to just turn to somebody next to you, find some, if you're sitting over there, you might have to join this group, but just talk for a moment, in your shared experience, where do you see these three characteristics of modernity in contemporary churches? In whatever form, you know, successful churches or not successful churches. So I'll just take a few minutes to discuss with your neighbor on that question. You can't be an individual in this room. It has to be part of the community. Alright, let's maybe one more minute. Let's close up to that last thought and then I'll collect your ideas. Or less than that. All right, maybe just a couple ideas. Where do you see modernism in contemporary churches? And then in this sense?
Church hoppers?
Okay.
People who say, this church doesn't meet my needs anymore, so I'm going to go over here where I like it better.
Okay. Okay, yeah, I think churches certainly have church hoppers on the one hand, and I think from a pastor's perspective, certainly, in the Protestant tradition, but I am frustrated from a church discipline standpoint that, you know, people, if they're uncomfortable with this notion that, you know, they're a sinner and they've been discovered at church, they can just go next door, and there's such a marked competitiveness, the other church feels like, yes, we got another one from across the street. So it's a little tricky, ecclesiastically, but yeah, I think individuals is still very rooted in what you see in churches. Any other ways the church has been modern in its mentality? Okay, so formulaic. I mean, I 40 days for this church, whatever. I mean, that's great. I think there's really great stuff happening there. But that is kind of a modernist mentality. VBS, is anybody not doing this year's VBS? I don't know who's behind that. It's a corner of the market. Anywhere you go, it's the same little Israel tribe, whatever they're doing this year. Island, I think it was Island something last year. But that's kind of a... that's kind of a methodological universalism, shot through the church. Any other ways the church is showing its modern colors?
I think in general, our whole life, our whole standards for things are standardized. The way you evaluate something is based on your sense of universal norms.
Okay, yeah.
And so you come into a setting and you say, this person is this person.
Yeah, there's sort of that successful church, and that's the image of success, regardless of where that church is located. And, our community, if it's going to be successful, has to look like that on all the fronts.
I wonder, underneath the number three there, the ambiguous individualism, what you've said is true, that it's tending to be more of a we vote with our dollars sort of thing. Is that tending back to pre-modern model where the nobility, had more quote unquote votes than the peasants did because they owned the land and they had all the wealth. And if you extrapolate that to the church, I may tithe and the guy next to me may tithe, but if he makes $500,000 a year and I only make $50,000, his vote counts more than mine, so to speak.
No, I think that's a very good insight. I do think that economic individualism might undercut the political individualism in some ways. And I had the exact same experience when I was sort of advocating for neighborhood church stuff in Missoula. An elder came to me and said, the people that really support this church financially are all commuters. So why would we do anything to help the neighborhood? Even though there were people coming, but those were the college students and the single-parent households and all the other people that done it on the money. So that, I think that really is playing out in the church, that kind of market, not just market getting them in the door thing, but market and evaluating people and how much they'll support them on the money. What about aggressive realism? Are we using that strategy of overcoming the contingency of nature?
I think a sense of dogmatism comes out of that. Okay. The way that the same way we can use our rational
Yeah, we're building big air conditioned buildings, expecting people to drive, a regional draw church is 60 miles, so it doesn't matter that that's using a lot of gas, that we've got that available, we can do it. So I think that's sort of an idea.
Video feed satellites.
Okay, yeah, using technology that way. I think those are all, I think we are seeing modernism in the churches. I suspect... now, I don't know, I don't have a lot of direct experience, but I suspect that some ministries that are claiming to be postmodern haven't really gotten past some of these, using technology. And again, I'm not saying that blogging is bad or evil or whatever, but I think that is sort of as a replacement for community, is expecting technology to shorten the distance between people. And it may ultimately shorten some distances, but I don't think by itself it shortens distance. I think the notion of a generational church, that we're going to do a church that's going to target this hip generation, is interesting. And I'm not, again, saying that's a flawed model on all fronts, but it's not, it's an individualist model in a way. Even though it's a community at a certain frozen point in their life cycle. So that's kind of individual. And I think sort of the globalized music that is hot in those modern churches is somewhat universal, you know, in a sense of we can pick up the coolest music from England or South Africa and use it in our, you know, just pipe it in, basically. There's sort of a standard way. That's not to say all postmodern ministries are failing by these standards, but I don't think many of them have overcome modernity as much as they think they do. One sort of interesting, and because I'm interested in the built environment, one interesting case study or image for postmodernity is postmodern architecture, which sort of postmodern architecture in this country really started in Las Vegas. Robert Venturi, prior to Venturi's work, who wrote a book called Learning from Las Vegas, the modern period in architecture was very much opposed to things like symbol or historical referent. So you would have these big blank buildings that didn't have peaked roofs and didn't have clear lintels and doorways, and they didn't look like buildings in Africa or buildings in Asia. They looked like international buildings, rational, clean, that kind of thing. That was sort of the thing. And then Robert Venturi took a group of architecture students to Las Vegas and discovered that the rules of modernism didn't apply in Las Vegas. The Caesar's Palace had, kind of this Greek agora look, and, he said, that's pretty cool, Historical referent, if it's done tongue-in-cheek, is kind of funny, and it's kind of fun. And so he wrote all about the different typologies of buildings in Las Vegas, and all of a sudden he started designing buildings with historical reference. So he put columns in, but he'd make them like over large, kind of Disney-esque columns. And he'd put peaked roofs on, but he'd make them kind of funny. And he put big signs in his building. And that is postmodern architecture. It's using bits and pieces of history, but it's not historical. It's not traditional in the way we generally think of that term. It's using, Caesar's Palace does not really culturally connect you to the Greek agora in any meaningful ways. The Luxor Palace, I spent a little time in Las Vegas recently, so I've got some direct knowledge. Luxor Palace, which is modeled on ancient Egypt, is very different from Egypt as it exists today. My daughter has an Egyptian friend last year from preschool, and my wife got to know her mom, and we had the pleasure of having an Egyptian family, or mom and daughter, come over for a play date. It was very interesting. Because it was during Ramadan, and so she was fasting and couldn't show her hair, and we're at a Christian theological seminary trying to entertain our guests. It's very difficult to have a casual one-hour conversation with somebody who you can't offer any food or really talk about food. You can't comfortably talk about the things that you're studying in seminary, and there's certain cultural taboos you need to be careful of. Anyway, that's all to say that that experience of entertaining an Egyptian family was very different from our experience of walking through the Luxor lobby in Las Vegas. In some ways, Las Vegas is postmodern in its architecture. It's got historical reference again, but in some ways, it's the most modern place in America. It's aggressive realism. There's nothing made, as far as I know, in Las Vegas. Everything's shipped in. There's no local products there. It uses more power and more water than it produces. than it produces any of that. Everything's built, according to a standardized type of building practice. It's certainly catered to the whims, especially the dark whims of all of our individuals. And so, as I think you see that in postmodern architecture, that you see buildings that make historical references, but they don't really tie into anything historical. And I see that a little bit in church ministries that are supposed to be postmodern. They'll use kind of a bit of ancient worship practice here, and a little bit of that, and a little bit of this. And all of it sort of to attract a certain commodity, give a commodity to a certain population to come and be part of worship. So I'm a little concerned that some of the postmodern ministry models aren't as postmodern as they might think. All right, so what I want to suggest as a more postmodern alternative is, again, following Borgman. Borgman sees that we have two options before us if we really want to get past modernism. He says one option is what he calls hypermodernism. That would be the Las Vegas model. try to overcome the problems of modernity through just applying more and more frantic modernist stuff at it. And so, you know, now a cell phone's not enough. We have to put the cell phone and the BlackBerry. And if we just were more efficient in scheduling our time, we could get more stuff done. That's sort of methodological universalism on steroids. And just more and more trying to figure out the categories of people and their individual cocoons, that's how we're going to succeed. All that stuff is kind of hyper-modernism. Borgman's alternative is what he calls postmodern realism. And postmodern realism has three characteristics. The first is what he calls focal practices. A focal practice is when you encounter a real thing in nature or a real thing, and you have to work with it in a way that requires skill from you as a human. So playing an instrument is a focal practice. You encounter a real violin, and you have to practice every day to get good at the violin, or you have to practice, and it requires you to use your human body and your mind to do this. The alternative to learning to play the violin is to, you know, download a violin sonata on your iPod and listen to it, or play it in your house. That's not a focal practice. That's a sort of hyper-modern alternative. So focal practice is an encounter with a thing. So he thinks going out on a run, you know, being a runner is a focal practice because you have to go uphills and downhills, and you sometimes it's snowing, and sometimes it's raining, and it's sunny, and it's hot. You have to deal with the reality of your environment. Cooking a meal is a focal practice because, especially if you got the recipe from your grandmother, because you have to deal with the reality of the food, but also the reality of the tradition of how to cook the food that was passed down to you. There's all these things going on. So focal practices lead to what he calls patient vigor. Patient vigor is if you take on a focal practice or a number of focal practices, you inevitably will encounter frustration in your focal practices. You will be frustrated in playing the violin. You'll want to go for a run and it's very icy on this day. But instead of trying to overcome the problem, defeat the nature through technology, you kind of ride through it. You practice when you don't want to. You put spikes on your shoes when you go running on the ice, or I guess it's a technology solution, but you run slower, or you figure out a path where there's less ice or something like that, and you kind of navigate the territory differently. So patient vigor is the kind of skill required to work with the thing. I like to think of learning to ride a horse or breaking a horse, which I've never done. That sounds kind of fun. You know, breaking a horse is a more of a focal practice in the sense that you're keying your body with the body of the horse in such a way that together you can go far and do these great things, as opposed to replacing a horse with a motorcycle and going twice as fast. But, you know, he's really concerned that we disburden ourselves through these kind of technological solutions from needing to be involved as a human. The third piece is communal celebration. And that is when we take on focal practices and need to use patient vigor, oftentimes that ties us into a community that also is interested in the same focal practice. Sometimes that community is sort of a citywide community, but sometimes it can be a group of people that play violin. You know, my son's in Suzuki, and he's got a little group he has to go to. And together, they can do sort of a celebration of the accomplishments that they've made, or runners do these kinds of things, where together we pass on the tradition of that local practice. We're not doing patient vigor all by ourselves, but, you know, together we do this. So these are that's what he calls postmodern realism. And I think that thinking about geography and proximity in ministry is a really good way to express postmodern realism in our ministry. By that I mean thinking about where we live in proximity to where we worship, or other kinds of things we do by way of expressing our Christian faith, is in some ways a key to a modernist alternative or a postmodern way of thinking about the Christian life, taking geography seriously. I mentioned the word, it's a fundamental decision. Borden also makes a distinction between ad hoc moral decisions and fundamental moral decisions. So an example would be, if you're a Christian and you are convicted by the notion that you need to love, show compassion to the stranger, and you say to yourself, whenever I see a stranger, I will show compassion to them as a Christian, that's fine. But if you happen to live in a house where you can get to your garage directly from the house, and you do that, you go into your car from the garage, from the house, drive your car across town, park in the basement of an office building, and then take the elevator up, and then see your coworkers there, you have set yourself up into a situation where you'll never really encounter a stranger. So you don't ever have to live out that ad hoc decision to care for the stranger. And Borgman would call that a fundamental decision. Where your house is, how your car is parked next to the house, where you work, and how you're going to get there, those are all fundamental decisions. And once you make that one fundamental decision, then your daily decisions will all depend on that fundamental decision. So the point I guess I want to get across is choosing where you live as a Christian is a fundamental decision. Depending on where you live and how that's set up and how that relates to the other things in your life, that's going to really have a bearing on the daily decisions that you make as a Christian. It may make it, you may be in an environment where you don't have to make certain kinds of decisions because of where you live. So that's my main thesis, and I'll just give you two models of how that, I'll give you two models of how that might be lived out in some ways. My particular way of understanding that is what I'm calling traditional urbanism, or traditional neighborhood life, that I really advocate for neighborhoods where you can walk to a local coffee shop, to a grocery store, where the houses are sort of oriented towards the street, so there's light in the front yards or on the front porches, so you can see people walking by. I like to line up as much things in your daily life, like or weekly life, including going to church, where you could get there by walking or by bicycle. You may choose to drive. This is an important distinction. You may choose to drive, but that's a choice. It's not a requirement. It's not as if you have, that's the only way to get from point A to point B. Now, sometimes that's done less perfect than others, but in general, the traditional urbanist way of taking geography seriously is to pick a place to live that allows you to do a lot of your activities within walking or biking distance. Sometimes it means once you've chosen a place to live, then you restrict some of your activities to those kind of things. So we've done that in Pasadena. We live in Southern California. We live in town in Pasadena, and you know, our kids want to do activities, and you know, I realize this is not possible in all cases, but you know, there's a gymnastics academy across the street, and there's a ballet school about five blocks away, and there, you know, there's things, we sort of pick our activities based on what we could walk to, because we don't want to spend our time in the car. So that's the kind of geographic proximity in a traditional setting. I'm going to read you a little excerpt from my book that I use to sort of illustrate the ministry implications of that traditional urban or neighborhood model as opposed to the suburban model and how that might play out in somebody's life. The way I do that is I retell the story of the hemorrhaging woman from, I think it's from the Gospel of Luke, and I tell it in a suburban context so that you can see how the disconnect between where we live in relation to other members of a congregation or from our church has a bearing on the kind of ministry we're able to do. So I don't need to read you the story of, I guess I'll read it to you. Okay, here we go. Jesus, you guys know the hemorrhaging woman, right? He's going to heal Jairus' daughter. On the way, he runs into a woman who touches the hem of his garment, and she's healed of a decades-long condition of bleeding. Try to imagine this story in a contemporary setting. Jesus is in a private home in a subdivision, where he gets a call from an elder of the megachurch 12 miles away whose daughter is sick. He and his disciples hop into their Suburban and drive 20 miles across town to another subdivision and heal the elder's daughter. The other parts of town they encounter at 40 miles per hour through shadow-proof glass. The hemorrhaging woman is in one of these other parts of town, perhaps in a seedy motel, alone in her pain, and convinced that she's not important enough for someone like Jesus. So the fact that in this story, Jesus lives in a suburban type arrangement where the only way to get to another member's house is to drive means that his main thing he thought he was supposed to do that day, you know, to go to heal Jairus' daughter, he accomplishes with modernist efficiency. But the secondary thing that he was supposed to do, that really was the main thing, the Holy Spirit would have him do, he's prevented from doing because he's going so fast and there's a glass between him and the woman in her pain. So that's my case for traditional urbanism, that when we're walking to church, when we're walking to another church member's house, we encounter other people in our local community, and sometimes that creates occasions for the Holy Spirit to have us do certain kinds of ministries. Now, I tend to be in that kind of framework. I love traditional urbanism, traditional neighborhoods. I've made a friend over the last couple of years who's got a totally different life background. He grew up in the suburbs and is a megachurch pastor. And he has read a lot of the same stuff that I have and has come up with some very interesting kinds of things. His name's Randy Frese, and he's written a book called The Connecting Church, which I really recommend to you from a suburban standpoint, thinking through this notion of geographic proximity. Frese has this large, I don't know how many acres, used to have this large megachurch, and he started reading stuff about traditional urbanism and traditional neighborhoods, and he came to the conclusion that everything we're doing in the megachurch is wrong. Because we build these huge fortresses, we let the drawbridges down, you know, on Sundays and then throughout the week, and let people come in, and we do our stuff here. And to be a really good member of this church, you need to abandon your neighborhood. And so all the really active members of our church are ghosts in their own neighborhood. And that's totally wrong, because, you know, the neighborhood is where things are happening. So he was having this thought, the megachurch model is wrong. And it struck him, I think this is how he tells the story. He was driving to a small group. From his house, he was going to a small group. And this small group was set up for his demographic type. You know, it was a small group of, you know, young, married men, three children, or whatever else. And he was going to the small group to share and have some accountability with other men in the exact same demographic category. And he was driving there, and he had two thoughts. One is, I don't want to go to this meeting. And his second thought was, I don't really think a lot of accountability is happening here. Because I'll show up, and we'll take turns telling what's going on in our life. We'll sort of tell our own version of what's going on in our life. We'll edit what we want, and we'll just hold back what we want. He said, you know, it really seems to me that the people who can keep me most accountable are my next-door neighbors, the people who live in my community. Because they can overhear me yelling at my kids. I can't just tell them about that. They see it. They see me making daily life decisions. And so he said, let's forget about, you know, driving to church, let's forget about driving to our special small group. Let's really focus on our home as a sort of place for doing ministry. They'll still gather on Sunday for worship, but he started telling his congregation, don't come to church throughout the week. Let's not do that anymore. Let's stay in your home, figure out who lives in your neighborhood, and try to get something going with them. And be really, don't make it overly spiritual. You know, have a chili feed on Sunday nights, or have you like cigar smoking on the back porch. I mean, whatever. Just get him into your house. And he did other random things in suburbia. Like, he took his swing set from the backyard and put it on the front yard. And I know it's illegal in some suburban areas, but, you know, all of a sudden neighborhood kids started coming over. And just through inviting people to come to his house, neighbors, you know, out on walks and see this activity, and they would be drawn into his house. And he started using his house as sort of a ministry center. He's got these great stories of, you know, this one couple that would walk every day, and one part of their church, or as far as he knew, they weren't Christians. They would see this, and they said, can we come over to the chili feed? And they'd come over. They wouldn't even, like, other than an opening prayer, they wouldn't have any special Bible study or anything like that. They got to know this couple. They started to know their neighbors because they were using their house in this way. Well, the woman contracted cancer, and they stopped walking one day, and he saw them and said, I haven't seen you for a while. And she told him, and she said, will you pray for us? And so she invited them into her home to start praying for her, and all of a sudden they're doing ministry. You know, but all of that is to say that he's taking advantage of the geographical proximity of where he lives. You can see either, you know, the geographical proximity of where your church is or where you live, and just taking that seriously as a context for ministry, I think, is really postmodern. In the sense that you're not trying to overcome all the contingencies of the local setting. You're actually kind of, you're walking around and you're noticing when the weather's bad, or you're offering someone a ride when it's icy or whatever. It's not individualist in the sense that you're sort of dealing with the reality of the place where you're placed. You're not sort of picking the actual demographic that suits your type. It's certainly not methodologically universal, because there's quirky things that happen if you're focused. I mean, we're going to a church just because it's in the neighborhood. Maybe it's not the church regionally would have chosen. It's, you know, it's times it's quirky. It's actually a covenant church. It's a great church, but I'm a Presbyterian pastor in a covenant church because it's in my neighborhood. So anyway, I think that's a really creative model. Frese actually then started deconstructing the megachurch. So instead of having the young adults meet at this time and then having the, you know, seniors meet at this time, he broke everything down by geography. So if you live in this elementary school district, this is your Sunday school class. If you live in this area, this is your Sunday school class. So everything's based on building networks among people who live close to each other, because he feels like that's the only place where Christian accountability can happen. So he's saying things like the megachurch model is dying, this is all wrong, we've been doing everything wrong. And I was having coffee with him a couple of springs ago now, and I noticed that Frese's book was published by Willow Creek Resources. So, when are they going to kick you out of the megachurch pastors club, Randy? And he said to me, you know, can you keep a secret? I've been called to be the teaching pastor at Willow Creek, and he's now there at Willow Creek. And I don't know, his agenda is to deconstruct the megachurch model. That it's nice to gather in thousands and thousands, and, you know, get that little glimpse of the eschaton, but ultimately that's not going to be the best thing for evangelism or accountability. All that stuff has to happen close to where we live and where we are. And that was really encouraging to me. I'm not necessarily, I don't know if everything he's going to do there I would necessarily endorse. But I think that's a really interesting way to think about life. I think they're doing more satellite feeds as a way of breaking under campus. They're looking for, I mean, they're desperately trying to rent out their space to community colleges. So they don't want to use it for church functions during the week. They want other groups to use it. So this is the kind of thinking that's going on. Anyway, I think that's all that I want to say. I want to leave a little time because I know that this notion of asking people to think really seriously about where they live is really, I think, is postmodern. I think it's relevant and effective way of thinking about ministry. But having said that, it is quite difficult because it's housing prices are so high right now, and there's so many compromises that we need to make, and issues of, you know, I want to live in this kind of setting, but my family doesn't want to come with me, or, you know, what about schools for my kid? There's all sorts of contingencies once you start asking the question of the fundamental decision of where am I going to live. So maybe we can start turning this into a conversation. We can talk about if you have any experience of people trying to figure out where they're going to live as a fundamental ministry choice or a discipleship choice. Have the situation to kick us off? Or confessions? That's the sound out. I think Frese has been a good friend in the way, in the sense that I no longer think in terms of, you know, one right model or something. I mean, he's just, you know, whatever. I think we can change the way we build communities. He's not so sure. So he's going to try to be faithful in a suburban context or whatever. Randy Frese, Frazee, The Connecting Church. It's in three parts. The first part's all about getting a biblical knowledge in your church. You can skip right. I mean, it's good, but if you want to get into stuff on local stuff, the second part is where he talks about living close together. It's very good. In fact, actually, I meant to read this. He's got, I think, five characteristics of real community, real accountability. One is spontaneity. You can't just have accountability with people that you have set times you run into. There has to be some spontaneous contact. That only happens usually where there's some geographic proximity. Availability. You have to be available to one another at random times. Borrow a car, pick frequency. You know, once a week is okay, but really, I would agree with this too. There are some people that you conceivably see every day. You know, some of my most colleges, so people come out of college with this, that frequency of somebody they see every day, and it's just a culture shock when they get out to the real world and you have to arrange for a lunch with their friends, and once a month they get to see them. So frequency, and I've only been able to establish frequency with people I've lived near. So some of the friends that I have these everyday friendships are ones that live near me. And if they move 3 miles away, the frequency stops. I mean, for me, that's really a live issue. And then common meals. He thinks it's very important to share meals together with people living near you. So that's why the chili feed. It's not completely. Yeah, I think that's really important. I think the CCDA has shown a lot of wisdom on that, the Christian Community Development Association with John Perkins, that they really emphasize, if you're going to do this, you stay in. And not everyone will be able to or can be able to, but I think the more you can get that expectation up front and really help people think through what that means to really be restricted by your geography and make that conscious choice, I think that's really an interesting place to challenge Christians.
I've always appreciated your writing. Might be where shall we live, but where shall we live if we want to help certain people as well? If there's a prisoner coming back from prison, where is the best place for that person to access the very things that you were talking about? If they don't have a car and so forth, and that they can walk to church, or a person who's disabled, we've been pushing a lot community group homes in the country. Well, are those persons that are living in those homes, are they having friends around those? Because we've just taken the institution and sometimes to put it into a community, and there's no contact interfacing with the persons that live around there and so forth. So maybe another way to look at basically what I'm saying is that not only where shall we live, but where shall we live in order to help people more effectively, and then the community. We live right nearby a church because we can walk to it, and that's exactly the point. And so the person that's living with us can access that as well.
Right. Yeah, that's good. I think I mentioned this in the last session that I in the whole affordable housing or elderly housing or transitional housing question, seems to me too isolated when you think simply about housing. Like getting somebody into a room that has these certain amenities. What we really ought to, while that's important, we need to raise our scale a bit and talk about putting people in adequate neighborhoods. Because especially poor people and other at-risk groups, a lot of their social services are not sort of rationalized. They're locally supported. You know, the grandma watches the kids because she lives here. And you can't just sort of move them around like chess pieces and expect that you can rationally meet all the needs. So really, geography is especially important for at-risk populations.
It seems like it.
Yeah, I think you're probably right. And especially if you're thinking long term, a lot of young people can move to an area, but things change radically when they get married, or when they're married, they start having kids, they start thinking about that. And I don't want to take the tack that, oh well, that's a sacrifice you have to make for the kingdom, right? I think taking that seriously and thinking about, okay, where are your kids gonna go to school? And I think some people solve that by homeschooling or, kind of getting into that movement, which I think has its merits. That hasn't been our family strategy. I think, investing in the local schools is important in terms of the family. I'm going to work up towards policy, I guess, in answering your question. But I think that in our family's case, we chose to live in Pasadena based on the school, but it was an inner city school and multiracial and multi-income for sure. But we and a lot of the parents made that decision together and have really, I think, done a lot to improve that school. A lot of families in Pasadena have just rejected the public school system and are in private schools, and I think that's affected the political climate. So the city council doesn't really support the public schools, but we are, you know, the school board elections are coming up in March, and we're really advocating for the candidates to have kids in public schools. And we're sort of taking a political, now that we've invested in the neighborhood, we've got enough lead, I guess we had enough lead time, and the benefit of other parents, that we're trying to improve the public schools in our neighborhood. But I do think that's sort of a frontline issue, that if, you know, as, you know, the Achilles heel of my argument in some ways is housing prices. All the really interesting places to live that have all these things are being quickly out of reach for most people, except the areas with crummy schools. You can still find a really interesting place to live in Detroit, for instance, or, you know, wherever. Nice house to live in, and with some good urban fabric, but maybe it's not a good place to send your kids. So I think a really good place for Christian advocacy is to figure out how to help public schools and really invest our energies there. My only, and I know this is in a CRC environment, it's sort of dangerous to suggest, my only problem with homeschooling and private school isn't that those are flawed in and of themselves, but it takes a lot of energy away from fixing public schools, which I think is a very important area to be with. So, yeah, it's huge. Yeah, I think that's a good question. Something to always keep in mind. I guess my short answer is whether or not the Christian community mobilizes to move into these neighborhoods or to be part of the neighborhood is in a way immaterial because other families are moving there ahead of you. And so that change is going to happen. My hope is that Christians, when they do it, they can partner with other Christians who do have some credibility with the folks in the neighborhood. Stay and come with creative solutions. They can be part of a solution that's more justice oriented than the one that we're likely to get without conscious Christian involvement. So I hesitate to say just move those neighborhoods as they are. I'm not thinking of a good reason why I hesitate to say it, but I think there's a, I mean, the dynamic that we're up against is poor people are forced to live when no one else wants. And so, you know, for a long time, that has been the inner cities, and that's less and less the case now. That's a real fundamental problem throughout history, that poor people live where no one else wants to live. The fact that that's shifting now, we need to address that, but I don't think we can sort of stop the tide of where people want to live now. So, yeah, I think, well, I guess what I'm saying is I'm not comfortable with strategy that it would depend on a case-to-case basis. Some people are saying, I like my neighborhood just the way it is. Some people do want to see change. Some people do can leverage the change for their good. Homeowners, at least, can take advantage of the rise of property values. Anyway, in Los Angeles, what we're dealing with is ethnic neighborhoods are changing their character. And that's kind of a big issue. It's not just simply being forced out, but there are ways to mitigate some of that, but you know the ethnic grocery stores are moving out because the national chain retail is coming in to take advantage of the new population. So trying to preserve some ethnic flavor for our neighborhood is kind of what we're after. But yeah, that's an important issue. Not an easy answer.
Can you flesh out a little bit the idea of the fundamental choice and the words used for that, and kind of how that makes sense in terms of like I've been thinking a lot in terms of spiritual disciplines and how you have all the private disciplines, but then you have these public disciplines. Small group of incense can be a kind of spiritual discipline, just like church activities and everything else. But you're talking about these fundamental choices. I was wondering if you could flesh that out.
I think I actually haven't read extensively this area, but I think it comes out of a virtue ethics tradition, in the sense that traditionally ethics were construed as, you know, what would you do in somebody's dying of something, would you pull the plug in this extreme case, or what do you do if you, would you push the button and do a nuclear bomb in this situation? There's always really extreme cases, and right and wrong. That's sort of the nature of ethical debate, is what's the right thing versus the wrong thing. Well, ethicists have since come to realize that most people, while those are interesting things to talk about, most people don't live their lives in those, you know, limited cases. They live their lives getting out of bed, making coffee, getting into their car, and, you know, they kind of have patterns of life that they've established. And there's sort of an ethical nature to the patterns that you adopt. And that's where, that's where virtue ethics kind of comes in. You cultivate virtues that sort of fit with the patterns of your life. And it's not case-by-case decisions all the time. It's almost like patterns. And these patterns aren't always individual. Sometimes there's community-wide patterns, habits of the community. And so a very interesting area to think about ethical or discipleship decisions is what kind of patterns are you tying into? What kinds of larger communities are you, you know, what kind of rituals? As we're rethinking traditional ways of working, traditional gender roles of doing things, those are all well and good, but we've yet to come up with patterns, you know, that would follow that. So I'm...
Is there any good writing just on that topic?
Alistair McIntyre has kind of led that discussion, but and Stanley Hauerwas has challenged... Some virtue ethics has been critiqued because it's based on classical notions of virtue, which is based on a warrior culture, you know, et cetera, et cetera. So Hauerwas wants to say there's a virtue theory is good, but we need to think it through from the Beatitudes and think through with a real Christian value, not just how to be a great Greek hero, but how to be a disciple of Jesus Christ. And I think that's a fair criticism.
But study math until you're 50, right?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So anyway, there's a whole literature on virtue ethics that I think would get you into that notion of fundamental choices versus.
Housing allowance, ministers, where churches say some stuff about that, reflection on what you're talking about.
Yeah, it's tough for any, I mean, the police chief of Beverly Hills cannot afford to live in Beverly Hills. It's tough for a lot of public servants that live and serve the communities in which they live, which if this stuff is true, is a real problem. You know, if you don't have local, on-the-ground knowledge, it's hard to serve your community. And so how do pastors afford to live in these areas? Well, again, manses are sort of out now. Maybe they'll come back. But they were problematic because you'd be in a manse through your whole career, and then you retire, you don't have equity, and et cetera. But in Los Angeles, that's something more and more attractive to have a manse come with your job. You know, I think congregations need to take things like equity sharing more seriously, where you take, as part of your capital campaign for building or whatever else, you raise money, a couple hundred thousand dollars in L.A. or $500,000, where... When you call a pastor, you co-invest in a house. The church owns $500,000 of the mortgage, and the pastor pays, you know, their down payment and whatever else, and that makes their mortgage payments manageable. When the pastor moves and they sell the house, the church gets back a portion of the equity that was invested initially, based on if the property went up and now you're down. It's kind of a co-investment. So they keep, instead of a man, they've got a fund to help pay for pastors to live in the neighborhood of the church. That's one solution that's coming in from Los Angeles. The Fuller Center is doing that as well.
No interest loans.
Oh, yeah, no interest loans will help. Yeah, that's another. Yeah, that, again, I think with crazy housing markets, just that notion of trying, if the church is going to put $500,000 down, it's a little easier to think about as potentially growing time. Or at least, I feel like that keys you with the market. For better or for worse, you can always guarantee that someone will buy in that neighborhood. So, I think we're out of time, so thank you. It's been